You've been listening to The Power of Nightmares, The Rise of the Politics of Fear, part two of a three-part documentary by the British filmmaker Adam Curtis, adapted for radio. We'll conclude with part three next week. This is Unwelcome Guests. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR, Knoxville. Dennis Bernstein is one of the finest investigative journalists in radio. His daily program, Flashpoints, is heard on community radio station KPFA in Berkeley, California. Last week, he spoke with David Ray Griffin on his new book that uncovers the 9/11 cover-up.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. We are delighted to welcome back to these airwaves David Ray Griffin. You might remember his book, The New Pearl Harbor, which was a terrific work in raising key questions about the lack of real investigation and a thorough look at what happened before, during, and after the 9/11 attack on the Twin Towers. Well, he's back. He's got a new book. The book is called The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, and that's exactly what we want to talk about, omissions and distortions. Well, it's good to have you, and I guess as a way of overview, why don't you tell us why you titled your book as you did?
Well, I expected it to be bad. I expected it to be a whitewash, but as I say in the introduction, I was really shocked by just the sheer number of omissions and the audacity of the distortions in this report. And the overall message of this book is that the impact it had on me, that any doubt I had after writing the earlier book that the administration was involved was overcome by this, because if the 9/11 Commission had to resort to such omissions and distortions, in other words, lies, dozens and dozens of lies, then they had to be covering up crimes in the highest places.
All right, let's just talk about the book. Give us more of an overview and talk a little bit about the methodology you used.
Well, the day after the 9/11 Commission report came out, I got a copy and I started reading it. And as I say, I was immediately shocked. On the very first page, for example, one of the things I had discussed in the earlier book, The New Pearl Harbor, was the fact that several of the hijackers, at least six of them, the alleged hijackers, have been shown to be still alive. And this is now well known in the 9/11 community, and it was in my book, and many, many copies of my book were given to the 9/11 Commission, so they surely know this. Nevertheless, on the very first page of the 9/11 Commission report, they cite these hijackers, all 19 of them, the same original names. Even in the middle of the book, they give photographs. They go into great detail about these hijackers' families. And not a single mention of the fact that at least six of them have shown up alive. So my method was simply to read the book in the light of my previous book, in which I had summarized the results of the researches of other people to show that there were dozens and dozens of questions to ask about the official story about 9/11, and so I read the report to see how it handled them, I found out that the rest of the book was just like this first chapter with the hijackers. That is, it handled all the questions by simply ignoring them, or in a few cases where they evidently thought they could make a point and make a rebuttal, they do that, but only by distorting the facts.
All right. And before we jump into that discussion about the hijackers and talk a little bit more about it, talk about the makeup of the committee and the investigative structure and why that in itself, in other words, the people who put the investigation together and supervised it, are not trustworthy or need to be questioned or conflicted, if you will.
Yes. Well, the subtitle of my book is A Critique of the Cain-Zelikow Report. Quite often we refer to commissions like this by the name of the chairman. So many people call this the Cain Commission, after Thomas Cain, the chairman. But much more important than Cain, actually, was the executive director, and this was Philip Zelikow. As executive director, he was in charge of the staff, and this got very little attention in the press, but it's crucial because it's the staff that did all the work. These commissioners we saw on TV, they just showed up and dealt with the reports that the staff had worked out, and so in some cases probably didn't even know about the omissions that the staff had perpetrated and their distortions. But in any case, Zelikow, why this is important is he's virtually a member of the Bush White House. He was a member of the first Bush White House, where he got to know Condoleezza Rice, and they became such close colleagues that they wrote a book together while the Republicans were out of office. Then she brought him in to help her with the transition after she was appointed National Security Advisor for the Bush II White House. And then he was also appointed to the Foreign Policy Board by George Bush the second. And so if we think of the 9/11 report as a report about how did the White House handle 9/11, which is the crucial question, you essentially had the White House investigating itself. We would not have tolerated it if we had said, well, let's make Dick Cheney or Condoleezza Rice put them in charge of the 9/11 commission. But Philip Zelikow is just as bad, and yet that's exactly what it is. And also in the final, in the conclusion of the book, I report that Peter Lanz, in his recent and very important book called Cover Up, reports that he had a friend, a confidant, inside the 9/11 Commission staff, and this staff person said that Zelikow totally directed the staff, and of the, I believe, nine committees there were who were to deal with the various topics, that Zelikow completely controlled all but one of them.
That's the voice of David Ray Griffin, and his new book is The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, and there were many, that's for sure. Now let's come back to your chapter about the alleged hijackers. And as you pointed out in describing how you put the book together, there was the sense that one gets or the public has is that the hijackers are all dead. So you're saying they're alive. And what's the significance of the fact that they're still alive?
What we have, and the way I set up the book, is the question of we've got two conspiracy theories. Now, you know, people say they reject conspiracy theories, but the official story about 9/11 is the original conspiracy theory, that 9/11 was brought about by a conspiracy among Muslims directed by Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda. And these 19 devout Muslims were the ones who brought off the hijacking. And it's important that they were devout Muslims because they were, you know, obviously ready to meet their maker. And so death was no problem for them. But now we learn that at least six of them were not on the planes because they're still alive. Then we learn also that Muhammad Atta, who is supposed to be the ringleader, far from being a devout Muslim, and the 9/11 Commission report says he had become a fanatical Muslim, this guy notoriously enjoyed lap dances, alcohol, ate pork, which Muslims can't do, gambled, lived with a prostitute. So we don't know the truth about him. Hani Hanjour was supposed to be the pilot of the plane that hit the Pentagon, and it had to make this incredibly difficult downward spiral which many pilots say they're not sure they could pull off in a 757, and yet he was known as a horrible pilot. And so we have severe questions about at least 8 of the hijackers, and we don't know that any of the 19 hijackers that have been named and were dealt with at such great length in the 9/11 Commission report were actually on the plane. Maybe all 19 of them were made up. Maybe there, you know, maybe there were no hijackers. We just don't know. And the 9/11 Commission report shed no light whatsoever on this. It just repeated the official story.
Well, we have information based on Seymour Hersh's investigation of the way in which the Bush administration has carried out extra-legal kidnapping operations. They've got the CIA. They've got special squads where they go all over the world. They kidnap people. They bring them to torture centers in Syria. And they, if you will, debrief them. You would think if the CIA is willing to have a secret plan to go around the world kidnapping people, if these hijackers were still alive, why wouldn't they go after them?
That's a very good question.
Okay. That's just one more good question. Let's just focus for a moment, speaking in terms of the Saudi situation. Michael
but
Moore...
Let me respond to that. I mean, the in case listeners didn't get the point... I mean, the point is that what we've been told about Osama bin Laden does not jive with many facts, both before 9/11. We have it on very good authority that a CIA agent visited Osama bin Laden in July of 2001. In other words, very shortly before 9/11. We also have numerous reports suggesting that when we were supposedly trying to get him dead or alive in Afghanistan, that repeatedly the U.S. military let him go in the final assault there on the Tora Bora, that they blocked only one of the two roads leading to Pakistan and just let him go. So that's the serious point here, is that maybe all of them were, you know, whoever was involved, if there were some hijackers on there, that they were agents of the U.S. government, or who knows. So it's so complex that I don't try to get into the questions of what really happened, but simply point out that the official story doesn't make any sense.
Now, talk a little bit about the issue that Michael Moore raises in Fahrenheit 9/11. You've got a chapter that deals with the Saudi flights. Remind people what Moore was saying and what you're saying about these flights that apparently took a whole bunch of Saudis out of the country before the airspace over the U.S. was shut down right after 9/11.
There are two dimensions to this story. One is that on September 13th, 2 days after 9/11, while American airspace had not been reopened, to private flights, that some Saudi private flights were allowed, and presumably that could only happen with White House authorization. The second part of the story is that that some flights went out of the country, not necessarily before then, although there seemed to be a couple that did, but that mainly they were not interrogated. And some of the people who allegedly, we learned later, had prior knowledge of 9/11 were on those flights. And then there was Osama bin Laden's own brother, who was on one of those flights, and where they were not interrogated. But let me go back to the September 13th, because Michael Moore was roundly ridiculed in the press, and then many press people used the 9/11 report to argue that Michael Moore was all wet, because the 9/11 Commission showed that there was no ban on flights on the 13th. And here it looks like deliberate distortion, because it was very clear, and Unger had made very clear, that at 11 o'clock that morning, they allowed commercial flights to start going, but put out a special notice saying, be very clear, this is only for commercial flights. Any private flights will be forced down. And yet this private flight went from Tampa to Lexington at 4 o'clock that afternoon. And so Michael Moore and Craig Unger were absolutely right that this was in violation of the shutdown, and that therefore it's most likely that there was White House authorization.
All right, let's come back to Osama bin Laden. That's perhaps the longest chapter in the book. We have heard that Osama was disinherited by his own family, the royal family, and we want to understand more about what you think in terms of his role and the bin Laden family. There's been a lot of discussion about the relationship between the bin Laden family and the Bush family. Not everybody thinks that's as important as some of the other things. So talk about Osama bin Laden in this context.
Well, the historical point, which one can read in great detail in Craig Unger's book, House of Bush, House of Saud, is that the Bushes and the bin Ladens go way back, and they've been involved in multi-million dollar business deals for a very long time. And some of them appear to be quite shady. With that background, the question must be raised, given these reports that I've just given about the apparent discrepancy between what the White House was saying about going after bin Laden and then the actual behavior, of whether we were really going after bin Laden or we're deliberately letting him go, which would make sense if he had actually been an agent, that is, if he had been an agent of the CIA, as he had been back during the war against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. Some people think that link between Osama bin Laden and the CIA was never broken, just as they think that the story that he became a black sheep and was disowned by his family is false, because they've shown up at weddings together. And just as the idea that he was persona non grata in Saudi Arabia and that they were totally opposed to him is suggested to be false by the fact that when he was in this hospital in Dubai, when the U.S. CIA agent apparently visited him, so did the head of Saudi intelligence. So the whole question is the relationship one that is almost the opposite of the picture that has been portrayed? And the 9/11 Commission did not even raise a single one of these questions. That's one of the gross omissions.
It is interesting that somebody like James Baker III, the former Secretary of State and the close associate of the Bush family, the man who, for instance, the Bushes called down in 2000 to, some believe, steal or help steal the 2000 election, James Baker is in fact the attorney for the Saudis, representing the Saudis in a certain context against the families of 9/11.
Yes, and so that's just one more illustration of this very cozy relationship that has existed for a long time, and particularly with the Bush administrations. And so another chapter in the book deals with this whole question of the relationship between the U.S. government, the Saudi government, and Al-Qaeda. And I show that very reputable sources, including the chairman, one of the co-chairmen of the joint inquiry, have suggested that they found out that there had actually been direct Saudi government financing of Al-Qaeda. The 9/11 Commission report repeats its little mantra: we have found no evidence that there has been any funding from any foreign government, and they say that specifically about Saudi Arabia, contradicting the very report that the 9/11 report was supposed to start with, that is, the joint inquiry's final report was given to the 9/11 Commission as their starting point. And so one of the many facts they omit is that that commission, the joint inquiry's report, had said there definitely was Saudi financing.
That's David Ray Griffin. His new book, The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, is just out. And we wanted to do a thorough interview about the investigation and what many believe was a cover-up. Let me direct you now to the FBI obstructions. Among the interesting people that didn't really make it very much into the 9/11 Commission, almost not at all, was Sybil Edmonds. She was a translator for the FBI. Talk about her and talk about what you see as the obstructionist role played by the FBI.
Yes, for listeners who don't know, Sybil Edmonds was hired after 9/11 as a translator. She quickly discovered that one of her co-translators, who had also been hired, was still working for one of the organizations that she was supposed to be investigating and supposed to be translating, and Sybil found out that either she was not translating these documents or she was translating them inaccurately. And furthermore, this woman approached her then and said that she was a spy for this organization, and would Sybil Edmonds join her? And so naturally, Sybil went to her superiors and told them about it, and they told her to shut up. And
so who was the person and what was the organization?
She does not reveal the organization, but the woman's name was Melikan Dickerson. It's in both of my books, so people can get the details. And so then she went to the Justice Department, and the Justice Department slapped a gag order on her so that she's not allowed to talk in public about details of this. She's been trying ever since then to get this opened up, and she thought one route might be the 9/11 Commission. So she volunteered to tell her story to them. She says that she testified for 3.5 hours. She, in a later letter, has laid out 8 major points that she made to the commission, some of them, well, actually all of them, absolutely damning points about corruption within the FBI and cover-ups. For example, that an Iranian asset had given them information about the attacks, about Osama, prior to 9/11, and they were just told to shut up and keep quiet about it. And so she told them all this, and the upshot of her 3.5 hours of testimony was one tiny note in the back of the book, among many pages of notes in very fine print, in which it says that she was one of 4 people who suggested the FBI should make sure it follows its own procedures. So, very relatively innocuous suggestion. If you compare that with the 8 points, and I repeat 5 of them in my book, you see that this is another gross cover-up. And back to the problem then of the commission, it was not just Zelikow. But people may think when they hear about the staff that these were bright-eyed college students or people just out of college who were eager to get the truth about 9/11. No, these were, at least half of them, were former members of the very organizations they were supposed to be investigating. So you had several members who were former FBI members. And so you know that they have friends who are still in the FBI. They have loyalty to the FBI. You had many, many members who are former members of the Justice Department, CIA, immigration. So you had those entities essentially investigating themselves. And this is why people ask, why are no names named? Well, they were not going to name the names of themselves. In some cases, they were actually investigating events that happened under their own watches.
All right, now I want to come back to Sybil Edmonds, the translator who volunteered, who gave, she says, 3.5 hours of testimony. I asked you before, she was concerned that she was working with another translator who was not translating documents that had to do with an organization they were investigating regarding 9/11. Why can't we know the name of that organization? Why won't she tell us?
I think that is part of the gag order, that she's actually not even allowed to say what languages she was translating. So it's a Justice Department gag order that puts severe restrictions on what she can say. And so she's been trying now for almost 3 years to get that lifted. And I tell the case in the second edition of my New Pearl Harbor. I bring the reader up to date on that, because in the first edition I had one or two paragraphs about her, and then the story had grown so much, and it had become, it's something that's been reported quite regularly in the New York Times and so on. So you know that the 9/11 commissioners had to know about it. And yet they give no space to it whatsoever.
All right, David Ray Griffin, let's turn our attention to the actual actions, the striking of the buildings. In your second chapter, you talk about the collapse of the World Trade Center buildings. Talk a little bit about what you see is crucial in terms of what we know or how we may have been misled about what happened in terms of the collapse of the towers. And Building 7, I guess.
Yes, and let me start with Building Number 7, because it has always been considered the most mysterious of the collapses, because obviously no plane hit it, so you can't say that it was weakened by the impact. So it had no fuel oil in it, so you can't say that it was the jet fuel that caused this fire and so on. And FEMA, which was given the task of coming up with an explanation, essentially said it couldn't give an explanation. It gave a very fantastic scenario, which how it might have happened, and it itself said the best explanation we can give has a very low probability of occurrence. So, well, how did the 9/11 Commission tackle this? It simply omitted any mention of Building 7 whatsoever. So one of the biggest mysteries of the 21st century, why did this giant skyscraper fall down, which is particularly mysterious in that it only had relatively small fires on two of its 47 floors. So the idea that these small fires could have brought down this giant skyscraper and in about 12 seconds, just like a controlled demolition, is of course absurd. With regard to the towers,
and why is that? I mean, and so, what are we suggesting, that there was some kind of explosives planted, that it was internal inside?
Well, that's one of the questions I point out that they don't discuss, is the fact that Building Number 7 and the towers had 10 characteristics that are standard characteristics of controlled demolitions, and that's where you plant explosives throughout the building and very precise places to break the steel, and also you put it on a computer so that it comes down in a certain order, and that's why these are controlled, so they fall directly straight down into their footprints, because if these 110-story buildings, which the Twin Towers were, had fallen sideways, they would have caused devastation throughout, much of Manhattan. And so it's very important that they come straight down. And so they have all the features. That is, they do fall straight down. They fall down at virtually free fall speed. One of the, eight other characteristics, such as the molten steel, such as the seismic vibrations and so on at the time that the explosives would have gone off in the sub-basements. But another feature that is very important about the Twin Towers is that these towers, their most distinctive feature was that their core consisted of 47 massive steel columns, which went from the sub-basements to the 110th floor. Now, the official theory, those who accept the official story, is that the fire somehow caused the floors to pancake. That is, one floor fell, and then it fell on the floor below it and broke it loose, and then all those floors fell on the floors below those and pancaked all the way down. Well, first of all, the idea that they could pancake at free fall speed virtually is incredible. But another incredible thing is that if you're old enough to know about the old phonographs that had a spindle sticking up in the middle of the records, sometimes the records did pancake. They would all fall down, but the spindle was still sticking up into the air. Well, likewise, if these floors had pancaked, you would have had those steel columns sticking hundreds of feet up into the air. But as we all know, we've seen the pictures, the collapse was total, and the rubble is no more than three stories high. So how did those massive steel columns all fall down? How does the 9/11 Commission report handles that? It just denies that there were any columns. It says that the core of each building consisted of a hollow steel shaft in which were the elevators and the stairwells. And the truth was it consisted of these 47 massive steel columns in between which were the elevators and the stairwells. So either the commission had to be terribly ignorant or they had to be telling an enormous lie.
Now, what about, let's focus on the Pentagon. What about the strike on the Pentagon do you find questionable?
Well, again, that the 9/11 commission did not deal with any of the questions that have been raised publicly, and they know they have been raised. One of the questions is, the one I mentioned earlier, how could have Hani Hanjour, a horrible pilot, pulled off this amazing acrobatic trick, and so that he brought this giant 757 in at treetop level. They lie and they say it dove into the Pentagon. Well, if it dove into the Pentagon, it would have hit the roof. But no, it came down and hit the bottom floor, the bottom two floors. So it was coming along at ground level at several hundred miles an hour. No terrible amateur pilot could have done anything remotely like that. So that's one issue. Another issue is, why would the terrorist have struck the West Wing? All the top brass and Rumsfeld were in the East Wing. If these terrorists were these geniuses that they're portrayed to be that could pull off this attack and, fool all of our defenses, they surely would have known which part of the Pentagon to hit to really inflict damage, and yet they chose the worst part. That is, the West Wing was being renovated, no top brass there, and in fact, most of the people in there were civilians who were working on the renovation. So it actually killed more civilians than it did military people or even Pentagon employees. A third question is, they ignore the fact that there are photos, one taken by a Marine, which shows that a half hour after this giant airplane allegedly hit the facade of the West Wing, the facade is still standing. And there's simply a small hole in it, and it didn't collapse for about a half hour. How is that conceivable if it had just been hit by a Boeing 757? And furthermore, where is the Boeing in all the pictures that we've seen? It's not outside. Anybody can see that on any of these websites that I refer the reader to. And the people who went inside, like the fire chief, said it wasn't in there. They didn't see any Boeing airplane parts, any big thing, fuselage, engines, or anything. So there's question after question after question about the official story that the Pentagon was hit by Flight 77, which was a 757. The 9/11 report handles all these questions by simply ignoring them.
Wait a minute. The 757 that hit the Pentagon, there are no artifacts?
There are some artifacts of airplane in the Pentagon, but they seem to be much smaller than artifacts from a 757.
And what would be the significance of a different plane?
Well, that it was not Flight 77 that hit the Pentagon, and so they've told a massive lie.
My name is Dennis Bernstein. We're speaking with David Ray Griffin. He was formerly the author of The New Pearl Harbor. He's got a follow-up book, The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, and we are spending this hour speaking with him about his new book. In the second part of your book, titled The Commission's Defense of the U.S. Military, you claim that instead of really trying to find out how the military failed and why they, if you will, stood down, commission attempts just to protect them, cover up, and not investigate. Could you talk about that and what you mean by a stand down or stood down?
Since 9/11, critics have been alleging that these attacks simply could not have succeeded given standard operating procedures by which the FAA, if there is any sign that a plane has been hijacked, immediately, within a minute, notifies the military, and then the military sends up normally two jet fighters from the nearest base that has jet fighters on alert, and they go up and intercept the flight and see what's wrong and actually give it instructions saying follow me, and then if they don't, they give a fire a warning shot and so on. That would be normal protocol. The main point here is that normally these interceptions would occur within 10 to 15 minutes after the first signs of hijacking. And yet on 9/11, these flights went 20, 30, or even 40 minutes without any planes being sent to intercept them. And so all along, the critics have been saying, therefore, the military must have had a stand down. That is, momentary cancellation of standard operating procedures. So the question is, how was the 9/11 Commission going to defend the military against this charge? Well, they did it by creating a new story that contradicted everything the military had been saying before. And in fact, the military had previously contradicted itself, so this was the third version. The first official story, which the military was telling the first two or three days, was that they didn't send up any fighters until after the Pentagon was hit. In other words, until after about an hour and a half after things were clearly going wrong. But that evidently appeared too clearly to be a stand-down. Some news reporters were saying, well, why weren't jets sent up? And so within a week, and actually CBS News within two or three days was giving out the new story, which is, oh yes, we did send up planes, but they didn't get there in time. Well, critics looked at the new story, which was published on September 18th, 2001, which was put out by NORAD, and saw the times at which the military said the FAA told them, and then the times at which they ordered the planes to be scrambled, and then the fact that the planes didn't get there, they would still be 70 miles away or whatever. And the critics looked at that and figured out how fast these planes can go. F-15s can actually go over 1,800 miles an hour, so they can cover a lot of miles in 10 minutes. And said, look, even with your timeline, even if we believe this new story, it doesn't add up. The flight should have got there in time, certainly to stop the second crash on the World Trade Center, probably even the first one. And furthermore, definitely the strike on the Pentagon, because you had a lot of time. And so the 9/11 Commission handles this problem by creating a brand new timeline in which they make the FAA look even worse than the previous story had. The FAA in the second version was already terribly irresponsible by, instead of notifying the military within two or three minutes, you know, waited 20 or so minutes. All those people should have been fired, maybe prosecuted, but nothing happened. Well, the news story makes it even worse that they never notify them. They say that the first flight, they got some notification about 9 minutes, I think, notification on the first flight, flight 11, and absolutely no notification on the three other flights. And so the military was not to blame because, hey, they didn't know. As if, you know, they didn't have their own radar, and as if they weren't tuned in to all the systems that were broadcasting everything that was going on that day.
What is the significance of the memo written by Laura Brown of the FAA?
Well, she she comes right out and says that what the military is saying is simply untrue. She says that when they say that we were not notified, the military was not notified, that is not true. And she says that they're saying we didn't pick up the phone and make a specific phone call. Well, first of all, she says that did happen, but more importantly, that after there's some debate about when this, what they call phone bridge first started, which is just a conference call, and that the FAA, NORAD, the National Military Command Center, and the Pentagon, and the Secret Service, and several other agencies were all on the line, and they were all talking about what was going on, and that they specifically mentioned the hijacking of Flight 77 long before the crash. And so that the military's claim that they were never notified, that's the new claim that's being made here by the 9/11 Commission on behalf of the military, that this new claim that they were never notified or that they were only notified at 9:24 or whatever it was, is simply not true, that they were notified at least, my memory's a little fuzzy here, but at least 15 minutes before that, so that there was plenty of time to do this. I don't know what will happen to Laura Brown when people find out that she not only wrote this memo, but talked to me on the telephone for about a half hour one morning and gave me some more details. I hope she will not get fired, but it's quite possible.
We are talking about the 9/11 cover-up with David Ray Griffin, who has written a second book to follow up on the new Pearl Harbor. Let's talk about Vice President Cheney and when he went underground to the conference room. Why is that important, and what is that all about?
It's important primarily in relation to Flight 93, although somewhat important in relation to Flight 77. But let me focus on Flight 93. The controversy about it is whether it was shot down. And as I reported in the New Pearl Harbor, there is abundant testimony that it was shot down by the U.S. military. We even have it from Paul Wolfowitz, the Assistant Secretary of Defense, that the plane was being followed by one or two jet military airplanes who had it in its sights and were ready to shoot it down if necessary. Well, the 9/11 Commission report denies all those previous stories, which were just common fare. You know, reported in the New York Times and CBS and everybody, and even Paul Wolfowitz. And so they say no, they didn't even know that Flight 93 had been hijacked until after it had crashed. In other words, not until 10:03 or 10:06, depending on which of the disputed times you take. And, the question then is, the presumption is that Vice President Cheney was calling the shots that morning. He had gone down to the the conference room, which is presidential emergency operating center in the under the White House. And the stories that have come out are that he was calling the shots and directing things, and that he had gone down there about 9:15 or 9:20. And, of course, that would have given him plenty of time then to have been in charge of directing a shoot-down of Flight 93 at 10:03. So what does the 9/11 Commission do? It changes the timeline drastically. Even Cheney's own previous testimony is contradicted, as if he didn't know when he went down there. And they say he didn't go down stairs until much later, and then he lingered in the corridor between the two places, between the West Wing and the East Wing, for 20, 25 minutes, maybe a half hour, making a phone call to the president and watching things on TV and so on. So he didn't actually get into the shelter conference room until almost 10 o'clock, And so obviously it was too late for him to be in charge of anything. Well, not only does that contradict every previous story, including Cheney's own story as to when he went down there, including Richard Clark's and so on, it contradicts testimony given to the 9/11 Commission itself by Norman Mineta. Norman Mineta, Secretary of Transportation, had testified to the commission that he went down to the shelter conference room about 9:15, got there about 9:20, and that Vice President Cheney was already there and was clearly in charge, and he told stories that showed he had been there for a while already. The commission just blots out Norman Mineta's testimony and says, no, he wasn't down there at 9:15 or 9:20. He didn't get there down there till 9:58. That is probably it's hard to know which is the most extreme distortion in the whole book, but that certainly is a contender.
All right, David Ray Griffin, perhaps the most controversial part of this is the claims by many critics that the Pentagon, that the Bush administration had foreknowledge of the attacks, and that, in fact, they even participated in the facts. Now, I have to be honest with you, I haven't seen anything that is particularly compelling that I can even begin to put this forward. Can you make the case that, in fact, the administration did have prior knowledge?
Prior knowledge to the attacks in general?
Yes. Yeah, these planes hitting these towers. We know these two planes hit these two towers. Many critics are saying the government knew it was going to happen. Do you believe that?
Yes.
Tell us why.
First of all, there is abundant testimony, which the 9/11 Commission glosses over, simply ignores, that the administration had very specific knowledge, including from FBI agents, of the attack. So even if you thought the administration wasn't involved in the planning, that there is clear evidence that they would have known that the attacks were coming and therefore deliberately let them happen. So I go through in the book and repeat many of these facts that the 9/11 Commission ignores.
Give us some of what you think are most compelling.
Well, one of these, which the one case where the 9/11 Commission apparently thought it could bat one of these things down, so it actually mentioned it, has to do with these put options that were purchased on American and United Airlines in just a few days before 9/11. These, for hearers who don't know this, a put option is you're betting that the stock is going to plummet. And so buying a put option means that you can make an enormous amount of money if you buy a lot of them and the stock does go down drastically. Well, of course, right after 9/11, the stock on American and United did plummet. And people estimate, the estimates of how much the people who bought these options would have made run from 10 to 15 million to somewhere in a billion. So a lot of money was made that day. The 9/11 Commission tries to bat this down by saying, well, we found the agency that bought most of the United stock, the options on United, and we found that it had no conceivable relation to Al-Qaeda. So that's supposed to put the end to that. And, of course, the suppressed premise there is 9/11 was brought about entirely by Al-Qaeda. Nobody but Al-Qaeda would have known about the attacks in the advance. Therefore, if this agency had no relationship to Al-Qaeda, it couldn't have had inside knowledge. It just made a lucky purchase. But, of course, the commission didn't prove any of those premises. In fact, it didn't even argue them. It just assumed them. And, of course, my whole book is set up around the, as I said before, the two conspiracy theories. The one is that one. The other one is that the government or certain agencies, parts within the government, including quite likely the White House and the Pentagon, were involved not only in knowing about the attacks, but in arranging them. And clearly that would have to be the case if the military stood down on 9/11 that would very strongly suggest that the Pentagon was involved. And then if Vice President Cheney was involved in the shoot down order for Flight 93, that would very strongly suggest that at least part of the White House was involved.
In my very early days as a student, I was essentially studying to be a cop, an investigator. And one of the key aspects of investigation is motive. You must establish some kind of motive for a crime. Now, you spend quite a bit of time in your book dealing with possible motives of the Bush administration. You claim that the 9/11 Commission covered up the fact that the Bush administration had motives for wanting these attacks to occur. What are those motives, and why do you say the commission covered them up?
The three major motives that I and others have discussed, possible motives, were, first of all, the desire to have a pretext to attack Afghanistan in order to facilitate the building of the pipeline there for this for UNICAL, and also to establish military bases there to garner the Caspian Sea oil for the United States in future years. Secondly, the desire to attack Iraq, and I document that this goes back at least 10 years with many central members of the Bush administration. Thirdly, to jack up the military budget, and particularly the budget for the U.S. Space Command, which really means the not only the militarization of space, that has already happened, but the actual weaponization of space, putting weapons in space through which the whole planet can be dominated. And this is not paranoid fantasy. This comes directly out of the documents of the government, the federal government itself, that this is the desire to have control of space and be able to deny the use of space to other countries. And then you look at 9/11, and it was used then as the pretext for all of those things. We attacked Afghanistan rather about as quickly as we could get the military in shape, and this did fit with a prediction that has been widely reported, that one U.S. Official said that the war in Afghanistan would begin before the winter snows, and sure enough, it did. And that prediction had been made in July. Secondly, of course, Iraq. And thirdly, the military budget was jacked up enormously after 9/11, and particularly for the U.S. Space Command, which, incidentally, Donald Rumsfeld had, just before he became Secretary of Defense, had just finished being the chair of the commission on the U.S. Space Command, and was asking in there, will we be wise enough to put our money into this, or will we have to wait for a space Pearl Harbor, that is, for some sort of catastrophe, before we will take action? On the very night of 9/11, rather than being in mourning or shock, Rumsfeld was on the attack, attacking Senator Carl Levin, who had been blocking this increase in money for the U.S. military, and particularly the Space Command. And, of course, Rumsfeld got his way. Well, the 9/11 Commission mentions nothing of all this. And so the war in Afghanistan is portrayed as a humanitarian effort where we were trying to help the Afghans get back their civil rights, and the most self-interest we had was trying to keep it from being a place where terrorists could hang out. The war in Iraq is not presented as a war for oil. There is only one mention in there of oil, and it's very much of a hypothetical. And there is a mention of the fact that the military budget did go up, but there's no suggestion of a causal relation or that that might have been a motive. And certainly they don't mention that this document put out by the Project for the New American Century exactly 1 year before 9/11, which included many members who became members of the Bush administration, said in there that this effort to restructure the military and to get money for the Space Command would probably go very slowly, absent some catastrophic and catalyzing event, such as a new Pearl Harbor. The commission goes through in great detail, talks about statements by Osama bin Laden that it says, here's proof that he had intentions that were carried out on 9/11, but here was an intention that sounds like it was carried out on 9/11 by our own government and not a word about it.
All right, we're going to have to leave it right there. We have been speaking with David Ray Griffin. His new book is the 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. Incredibly interesting. We thank you, sir, for spending the hour with us.
You're welcome, Dennis. It was good to be with you.
And Dennis Bernstein of Flashpoints was the interviewer. Flashpoints is archived on the internet, and you can find more of their wonderful programs at www.flashpoints.net. Thanks to Dennis and the Flashpoints team for that material. And you can contact this program, Unwelcome Guests, at unwelcome@radioforall.net. That's radio, the number 4, A-L-L, dot net. For Finger Lakes residents fed up with the election fraud, lies, killing, torture, and the general administration of George Bush and Richard Cheney, there are two buses leaving from the area to go to the counter-inaugural protests in Washington, D.C. on January 20th. Tickets for the Ithaca bus are $40 and are available at Autumn Leaves Used Books on the Ithaca Commons downtown. For further information on that bus, contact Ithaca_inauguration@yahoo.com. Ithaca_inauguration@yahoo.com. A bus from Rochester is being chartered by Peace Action and Education. The fare is $60 or $30 for students and the unemployed, and it will depart from Monroe Community College. For more information on that bus, telephone 585-624-3673. 585-624-3673. You can also see this announcement on rochester.indymedia.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thanks for listening.
Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome travelers and other brave.
Information, we can defeat the enemy.